Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Go Forth, a music education talk show. This is Summer.
And this is Owen. And this week, we have a coffee talk interview with Dr. Elizabeth Parker, where she speaks about musical identity and her own research.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Go Forth, the music education show based in the Southern Conservatory of Music at Gettysburg College. My name is Logan Shippey, and I'm joined today by Dr. Elizabeth Parker, who is the Associate Professor of Music Education at Hoyer College of Music and Dance at Temple University. How are you doing today, Dr. Parker?
I am wonderful. Awesome to speak with you. Thanks for hosting me.
Thanks for coming on the show. Now, I'm going to start off with a simple question that might have a long answer. How did you get into music education? How did you get into the field?
I wanted to be a music teacher since I was in 10th grade. That's happened in all-state choir, which occurred in Atlantic City, New Jersey. I was born in New Jersey. And there was a conductor. I was amazed. It was my first all-state. It was the end of my sophomore year, I think. And I was just amazed at how this person could energize a room of 300 plus people to sing in that way. I never heard that sound. I'd never been taught that way. And I just said, that's what I want to do. I want to teach choral music. It was very specific. I was like, I want to be a choir teacher. And that was it. It was pretty much my decision-making moment. Prior to that, it's so funny because I really thought I wanted to be a lawyer. I'm not sure where that happened. But anyhow, I think it was a better choice for me to be a music teacher. And that was the end of that. I mean, I basically went undergrad, music ed, master's music ed, PhD. I mean, just straight away.
Well, you know, it's never too late. You could be the music teacher lawyer. That would be pretty cool.
I could. I thought about it. I thought it might be a useful, degree nowadays. Anyway.
So fascinating. Now, could you answer, what do you research now in the field of music education?
I've always researched adolescents and their perspectives on singing, and that I continue to do, but I've broadened to more adolescent experiences. My most recent research study is a recent book I published about adolescent musical identity, specifically how 30 different adolescents describe their musical development, because we don't have a lot of adolescent perspectives around how they see their own musical development and who have been the main influences and kind of what advice they could give for music educators. So that's been my most recent work, in addition to working on issues of disability in music and music education, something I'm also very passionate about. I look at disability from teacher perspective, like what's it like to be a teacher with a disability, and also how do we support students with disabilities in not just self-contained settings, but also in public school spaces where they're mixed in.
Yeah, so I'm going to focus in on adolescent musical identity and a part of that being vocal identity. So why is musical identity and vocal identity so important?
Because I've met too many people that use this, well, I'm not a musician, and so I really couldn't tell you, kind of a phrase as adults. I have met superb musicians who will not claim the title. I'm not a musician. They will not claim the word musician for themselves. And I started to unpack, well, why does that person not define themselves as a musician? What is it? How do we define the word musician for other people who then say, well, that's not who I am, but they're entirely musical their whole lives. And so I've reframed the idea of musical identity as being musical or feeling musical, because to me, that's really the goal of life-wide music making, is to feel like a musical person. The benefits of feeling musical in your life bring so much more fulfillment in being a part of musical experiences or attending them or whatever it is. I was kind of tired of that notion that only some people are musical and others are not. And those are relegated to the observer role, because by nature, human beings are musical people. So why can't we just all feel musical? And I think teachers, unfortunately, are in large part to blame for that, and how we've associated certain people being successful and worthy of a title of musician, and those as being, well, you're going to be an audience member someday, you're going to be an appreciator. And those divisions are, to me, unacceptable.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because I actually found something similar. I did, when we went remote last semester, there was a group of people around my neighborhood who just started going out into the streets and singing every day, just to have some sort of community and being able to see each other. And I interviewed a couple of those people, like, who started it, and they did not identify as musicians at all. And some of them had gone to college for music and were starting groups of singing. And they were like, no, I'm not a singer. No way. No way. So yeah, I found something graceful. And also, I think you touched on a point that that separation between the performers and the audience. Mm-hmm. That reminded me of a lot of what Christopher Small says about breaking down that Western idea of like the audience is up on top of the stage and all the other people mm-hmm. down below, you know, and we're all really musicers.
That's right. And I mean, he extends it to like the custodial staff and the ticket takers and the, you know, we're all part of a musical experience and we're just playing different roles. It's not like one person provides and the other person takes. We're all contributing. And yeah, it has been a lot of those Western institutions that have separated that idea, unfortunately.
So we've established that musical identity is really important and individual identity is really important. So how can a teacher promote individual identity while also creating a larger choral ensemble identity?
That's a really good question, Logan. It's a really hard one. I was hoping through some of my research to find better answers. I haven't found great answers. I do have a few ideas. One is that you do need to treat the group as a group and build a sense of group identity because they will work together, but there needs to be moments or times within that curriculum where you're fostering rather than allowing, you're fostering spaces for people to build in smaller groups, because in the research I've conducted, it's the small group space where the individuals feel like their voices matter more and they have more of a sense of connectedness and also agency as an individual. And thus, you can have that very large choir, 70, 80 voices, whatever it is, but that will really continue to reify the group space over and over and over again. And for some, that's they're happy there, meaning teachers, that's fine with them because that's how they view it. Teacher to student. And when I use student, I'm using it like everybody is the student rather than 1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1. And that was unfortunately the research I found very disappointing, was this notion of relationships. Some teachers really see a relationship as an ensemble relationship. They don't see student teacher individual relationships in a large ensemble space. So if you begin to view it like what's our ensemble relationship and what's our individual relationship, and how do I support both of those? And I think you can get closer to the idea of a small group doing some different kinds of work and reinforcing those self-identities. And then how do we work together as a very large group as well? So it does put one in a different priority sometimes. There are teachers that just do not want to imbalance, that this is the way they're happy. They're happy with a large ensemble and them, that's how they want it. I would push against the idea that that's good for everybody in that group.
So I immediately recoiled when you said small groups, because I immediately thought of cliques. Do you want to talk on that?
Yeah.
On that
I mean, group? I found cliques in almost every research study I've done. But, you know, having small groups doesn't mean that we're forming them as cliques. It's really getting them into working groups where they can mutually support each other in different roles. It's not like here you are, you know, this group of determining some clique-based, right, arrangement and supporting that. It's maybe it's a composition project or an arrangement project where they're arranging something together, and there's somebody who's great, you know, who's great at tech and somebody who's doing the beatboxing or whatever, and they're like working in this space. There will always be some kind of power relations. I think that's where you're going, Logan, is like there's really no way to just say like, oh, we don't have those here. There's always power relations. And I think we have to just pay special attention to that and be careful of those when we arrange this notion of small groups in our larger ensembles. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It just means we have to be really attentive to that and to who they are and know the students before we put them into those groups. We just like, you know, throw them in first day. Oh, I want you to, you know, create an arrangement and blah, blah, blah. We'd probably do some exploration and some practicing in what this looks like and how we would do this rather than stake just kind of going like, yeah, we're going to do this. Then we try. And I didn't think through it enough. I think that's not an option when it comes to those kinds of relationships.
Thanks for clarifying for me. That was a good thing. So I know they do a lot of research in gender in vocal ensembles, especially female voice identity. I wanted to ask you, how is vocal identity tied to gender identity?
That's a really hard question. I will just speak about the research I have conducted. I won't try to speak larger than that. But for girls, there is a lot of image there are a lot of issues with body and image in puberty and growing up. And there's a lot of, you know, it has to do with what's on the media. It has to do a lot with shame. And, you know, there's a lot going on for girls and bodies. And I'm not saying that's not true for other people. There's just a lot. And so to put a voice on that, and then also to think about the larger issues of discrimination against women and whether women have a voice, whether that's metaphorical or figurative or literal, that, you know, you start putting all these layers onto things and then you say, okay, and now you're going to sing, you're going to use an instrument in that very delicate, fragile space, and you're going to share that with people. I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot for a young person. To just be like, okay, so first of all, I don't really have a voice because generally there's a lot of discrimination against women. Then I may not like my body or what's going on. And now I have to share something that I'm creating where people are going to judge it. There's a lot of issues connected with vocal identity and gender. I mean, just putting all that together, like, wow, why would anyone sing at all? So it's been a very important, and the ways that women either their gender roles are reinforced or they're made to feel important based on the contribution that they give as a singer. So for example, altos, you know, if you can read music, there's certain messages that girls get, particularly girls get around musicianship. If you can sing really high, if you can read music, if you can keep a harmony part, if you can cut through, if you can, you know, there's all these different things. And the reason I was interested in researching it is because there's messages from different people about different ways to be who you are. And not a lot of people really invest in who you are. They just want you to be the thing that they need you to be at that time. So like, I want you to be the alto person who can cut through it because we need to hear more alto. It's not about like, Elizabeth, here you are. What do you have to offer us? It's like a role-based thing. And that to me is very connected to gender and utility and how we might be useful in the world. And how we might use our voices. And so one thing I've worked really hard at in my own personal work with choirs is to empower people's voices, not as role-based, like I will be this for you, but to empower them as people with voices who have feelings and perceptions and things to give, and really tread lightly on that idea of like, what's your function? Because that's, I think, how gender and voice has come together, unfortunately, for many of us.
Yeah, and I'll add, you spoke on adolescents not being comfortable with their voice. Me going into college and not having sung a day in my life, I was very uncomfortable and still very working vulnerable. Through that.
It's extremely vulnerable, very vulnerable, right? Yeah. Singing is a vulnerable act. And that was partly why looking at this idea, like we're embodying our sound, our perceptions, it can be similar for an instrumentalist, but you have something at least you're holding or you're behind or you're like, there's nothing behind or in, we're not behind anything. We're just here. Yeah. So I hear you, Logan.
Or maybe the folder is like, you're holding it up behind, in front of your face.
It feels better to me. I'll say a music stand kind of feels like home sometimes because you're like, well, at least I've got this music stand.
Definitely. Yes. I really enjoyed when you were talking about the functions of people and labeling. And I think that really ties into what you were saying before about seeing someone as an individual. You mentioned calling someone by name and asking what mm-hmm. they had to offer. And I think the labeling is very important, especially when like assigning a voice parts. And I also wanted to ask you on that topic, since vocal identity is so important to personal identity and gender identity, do you think that gendered choirs have a place in this work where we're becoming more aware about gender fluidity and how gender is really just like a social construct?
I kind of go back and forth to say, someday we won't need that. And then I'm like, maybe actually we should just plan gendered ensemble. The structure of our world is just still not in a place where we can say, well, we can empower all voices in an ensemble. I don't think we're there in most communities. And because of that, I do think that there needs to be at least divisions by, you know, upper voice, lower voice. I don't think they have, you know, the associations with gender identity, women's, I mean, there are so many different ways of going about it. I don't have a clear answer, just to say that I think we still need to create space for them and we need to still have them in programs. And that's true for lower voiced ensembles as well. I think we need all kinds of ensembles. Where I struggle is for our students who struggle with what that means and how they have to define themselves based on that voice part or what they want to sing. I think there can be fluidity. You can have lots of different people in an upper voice ensemble, just like you can in a lower voice ensemble. What does it mean though to be an upper voice ensemble? I don't know actually, except that it seems to me like a substitute for the phrase women's choirs. I don't think we've really changed much besides this idea that we sing in the treble clef. I think that's what that's supposed to mean. So until I can get kind of come to grips with what it means, I'm going to keep struggling with that. But I do think we need a protected space for girls to feel like they can kind of be who they need to be in a classroom. And that can occur a lot of ways. It doesn't just have to occur in music. It can occur a lot of different ways in the school building. But yeah, I think where we are right now, we still need that. Based on what I've been seeing lately, I think we need that a lot.
Definitely. Yeah, thank you so much. I'm going to round out our conversation with a little open-ended question. What are you working on next going forward?
I'm really working on wrapping some old things up, but I actually have been thinking about what's my next big, like, what am I going to keep going with adolescent voices? I am really fascinated with students that don't, you know, that leave music programs or don't choose to join music programs. And that was something that I should not have been surprised by in my book project, but I was quite surprised. The more I thought this was going to be a book about affirming the school music ed experience, the public school music ed experience, as I interviewed each adolescent, I thought they're going to tell me about how their musical identity is based on these public school experiences, and it's going to be like a really big advocacy book. And I think that's because I want that to be true. But most of them, I would say middle schoolers were much more in that space, but most of the high school students did not really assert their public school music experience as critically important to their musical identity. And that made me start to ask whose stories were missing, like whose narratives are we missing in music education, and how we have those adolescents inform us into building better school music programs. And so I think that's my next step, is really to find more students that are choosing not to participate, who are highly engaged musically, and learn more about them. I started doing that in that project more than I thought I would, but I think that's where I need to go. And those are particularly students of color, probably not surprising to anyone. But in my some of the research I've done in a few across projects, church, the role of church is really strong. And church serves a large music education function, particularly for communities of color. And then there's a whole lot of community organizations that are like entrepreneurship-based organizations in Philadelphia and around that are providing a lot of music education in production, musical production, and other things that don't exist in the schools, or they do exist, but the students just don't seem to think they're relevant. And so I'm really interested in spending more time in those spaces.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I haven't even thought about seeing the perspectives of people who don't continue with music to reinforce our musical system, our music education system. That's fascinating. I can't wait to read about that. Oh my gosh.
It's going to be about 5 years, Logan.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, that's fine.
A few things going on before then, but I'll get there.
That's all right. I got stuff to finish up too, and I won't be ready to read until 5 years from now. So. So thank you so much for coming on the show. It was really great.
We hope you enjoyed this week's Coffee Talk with Dr. Elizabeth Parker. To listen to the extended version of our show featuring our own students discussing various things, as well as our snazzy outro, feel free to look us up on wherever you get your podcast at Go Forth, a Music Education Talk Show. We hope you come next week where we interview Dr. Jason Holmes, but until